From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat today. And it's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. Today, our panel includes Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Sydney Kidd with BoiseDev.com, and Rachel Cohen, the South Central Idaho reporter for Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Sam.
Happy Friday.
Yay. Yeah, happy Friday.
Thanks. Great. Okay, so Scott, you're up first. In the past, Boise City and Ada County commissioners have clashed over homelessness, but they finally agreed to build a new affordable housing project on the Boise Bench. You wrote about this. The Statesman wrote about this. Tell me about it.
Yeah, Rachel Spotcheck, Idaho Statesman reporter, wrote a story about this partnership between Ada County and the city of Boise. And as you mentioned, the county commissioners and the city of Boise have clashed over how to address homelessness. And there's, you know, differing philosophies on how to do it. And the county has pulled back money from a couple of notable projects. One is New Path Community Housing, and another was housing folks at the Red Lion Hotel. People who were experiencing homelessness were staying there, and the county pulled back funding. So it was good news to see the county commissioners and the city of Boise working together on a project. This is called the McKinney Project. This is on McKinney Lane near Cole and Fairview in Boise. And the city of Boise purchased 2 acres of land for about $2.75 million last year as part of their strategy for building affordable housing. They partner with private businesses to build the housing. And this particular project is 250 units of apartments that's going to be built on the site. And the construction is going to cost about $69 million. And so the city, in addition to purchasing the land, is contributing $5 million toward the construction. Now, along with that, the Ada County Commissioners agreed to kick in $4.5 million toward the project. And their money is coming from the American Rescue Plan Act's Emergency Rental Assistance Program, which was a COVID pandemic era program. And the county, as part of that program, was required to spend 75% of that money on affordable housing. And so they agreed to kick in $4.5 million toward this project, which will go toward folks who are 60% or less, who make 60% or less of the area median income. They figure about 200 out of the units, out of the 250 units, will go toward folks who make 60% or less of the area median income. So that project is getting ready to get underway, and a good news story for folks and efforts to help folks who are exiting homelessness and hopefully make a dent in our homelessness problem.
Definitely a good news story there. Rachel, what's next for the Snake River? Idaho had to poison a big chunk of the waterway to kill off invasive quagga mussel larvae. What's the next step?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, you could look at it a few different ways. Ecologically, I think there's the question of what happens next, because, you know, this chemical was designed to kill mussels, and it does kill mussels. But, you know, it also kills other species like fish. And it did, in fact, kill a lot of fish, more than 3,000, and Fish and Game actually pulled out of the river dead fish, and together they weighed like 6 to 7 tons. So that's a lot of dead fish. And then there's the question of okay, this stretch of the river had the, you know, copper chemical released into it. What happens next for that ecosystem? And you know, it's sort of hard to tell, because this treatment was unprecedented in a lot of ways. A lot of mussel control has happened in lakes, and this is a river, which is a lot more complicated. And so, you know, they're gonna continue to monitor what happens to the fish populations there. Some of them will probably need to be reintroduced via hatchery breeding, like sturgeon, definitely, because, you know, they take a long time to grow. And then other, you know, scientific questions, I think, are just like, how long will it take the full, you know, aquatic community to return to this poisoned area? And so some USGS scientists are starting with the tiniest of creatures, aquatic insects, because they're like the bottom of the food chain. And so for them to get back there, it could signal things about how long the recovery will take, you know, a year, a couple of years, even more. And then, you know, as far as what's next for the river and how people use it, I think that's something that's going to continue to be discussed, including during the next legislative session. But what state officials have said is that, you know, going into this body of water in Twin Falls, it will look different. You know, you might need to get your boat washed before you enter and after you get out, to make sure it's decontaminated. And once quagga mussels have been found in a water body, that water body is essentially considered positive for the next 5 years. And so for the next 5 years, we're looking at changes to how people use that stretch of the river.
Interesting. 5 years. That's amazing. Okay, Clark, by now, most homeowners have received their property tax notices in the mail. Are they seeing a tax break this year?
Yeah, it depends on where they live, and it depends on the value of their property and kind of how that stacks up against everybody else in the state of Idaho. But the state of Idaho spent more than $300 to reduce property taxes this year. And as you mentioned, right around Thanksgiving is when the county started mailing out the property tax notices. The governor's office says the average savings was about 18% off of their property tax bill. I talked to the Ada County treasurer, and the median savings in Ada County was around $400 or $500. And so, everybody's is going to vary a little bit, but folks were seeing substantial savings. This had been a top issue and really continues to be a top issue, and its growth and its affordability. But Idahoans have been saying that they can't afford their property taxes, that they can't afford housing. And it had become a major issue in the state. Some public policy survey data had identified it as one of the issues that Idahoans said they were most concerned about. And so this last legislative session in 2023, the Idaho legislature passed its massive property tax reduction plan, and it sends money to school districts to reduce the payments for bonds and levies. It provides money specifically for owner-occupied homes, for homeowners who have the homestead exemption or the homeowner's exemption. And then there's an additional pot of money funded by the surplus that was for all property owners. The governor's office says that the savings was about 18%. Folks just started seeing those notices in the last week or two. And everyone's different, but there was some real money there. In terms of the median and in terms of the average, there was absolute savings there. It was important that when I talked to the Ada County Treasurer, she told me that the savings are for this year. There is money going forward. I think it's going to be coming from sales tax collections going forward. But each year, they're going to add up the property tax bills and the property tax savings. And so each year kind of stands on its own. They'll have to recalculate again, everything all over again next year. But there is funding moving forward for property tax reductions in the future as well. But it depends. If folks live in a different county where either they did not have a lot of school bonds and levies already on the books, or if they just approved a new bond for a jail, that might affect how much or whether or not they saw an actual savings. But overall, on the balance across the state, yes, folks did. And on average, in Ada County as well, folks did, to the tune of $400 to $500 somewhere in there.
Well, okay, and you answered my question about if that was one-time money. So, I'm going to jump on to Sydney. Sydney, tell us more about a bike path in Garden City that was closed down or will be closed down tomorrow by an HOA.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of people probably don't have cycling or the green belt on their mind today with all this snow. But just like you said, Samantha, starting tomorrow, there will be a bike path access way in Garden City connecting people to the green belt that will have a gate locked because an HOA has installed one in there. There's been some, you know, back and forth about if this was a public easement or if it was a private path for the people in the neighborhood to enjoy. And part of that confusion comes from the plot that was created in 1995, when this neighborhood was created in 1995. On the front of the plot, it says that the bike path is a public bike path easement. But on the back, if you look at the notes on the back of, or on the second page of the plot, it says the easements as shown on this plot are not dedicated to the public. So that's caused some disagreement between cycling advocates in the county, in Ada County, and the HOA president. And there's been, you know, the HOA has been concerned because a lot of people have been using this path and they say it's not designed for it. They say that there's been some accidents that have happened because of it and that there have been some near misses with cyclists and people in their cars. And they say they don't like that because they pay liability insurance on this bike pathway. But cyclists talk about how if this is closed, then they're going to have to use State Street, which they say is unsafe. There's been, you know, pedestrian and cyclist safety is a big topic right now. There's been some fatal accidents the past year that have really brought this to light. And they're saying if you take this bike pathway from us, it's going to take away access to the greenbelt for a lot of people. And it's going to make getting on the greenbelt more dangerous for cyclists who do continue to go and use their bikes.
It's interesting, and it's a very interesting subject. Recommend going and reading the story. And the gate gets locked tomorrow, right? And we're still waiting to see if anything's going to happen. Garden City says it's not going to get in the middle of this.
Yeah, Garden City said because of the way that the plot map is worded, that they don't feel comfortable, you know, getting involved, that they've said it's a civil matter. Cycling advocates are still pushing for help with keeping the pathway open to see what avenues they can get. And, but the HOA says that, you know, we're not going to keep this open. We will share the access code with people who live in homes near our home, people who are connected to our HOA and the surrounding HOAs, but this is not going to be a public thing.
Rachel, some groups are taking some legal action against shooting wolves from helicopters in Idaho. So it's a very emotional story. What's the background on this one?
Yeah, so there are several layers to this. It's a bit confusing, but three environmental nonprofits are petitioning the U.S. Forest Service to stop private contractors from shooting wolves or other predators from planes or helicopters, and specifically on national forest lands in Idaho. There is a federal law called the Airborne Hunting Act of 1972, and it bans hunting wildlife from aircraft. There are exceptions. You know, you could, it could be reasons to protect livestock, or if a person has a permit from the state, Idaho does issue permits for this purpose, but you know, it's, you do need a permit. And so the reason why these environmental groups are petitioning now is because the Idaho Wolf Depredation Control Board recently approved projects to reimburse ranchers for killing wolves that threaten their livestock. And some of the projects plan for private contractors to kill wolves on their behalf. And some of the methods included in those project proposals, mention using helicopters or planes. And so these environmental groups are worried that this method of killing wolves in Idaho will expand and that it could pour into federal lands. And so they're calling on the federal government to put a stop to it. It's not exactly clear what's going to happen next, but the Wolf Depredation Control Board does need to finalize these project proposals. So, we could see if any potentially changes are made to those because of this petition. I heard back from the Forest Service, and the Forest Service said the agency does not manage wildlife on federal lands, even though the federal law against hunting from aircraft is under their purview. So it's unclear what's going to happen next. The environmental groups did threaten to sue the Forest Service if they don't hear back.
Okay, that is very complex, and I think I have a headache. Clark, the Secretary of State of Idaho says he can't enforce a new GOP voter deadline. Why not?
The long and the short of it, Sam, is because the Secretary of State says his job is to enforce Idaho law. Idaho laws passed by the Idaho legislature, not rules passed by a political party. In this case, we're talking about the Idaho Republican Party. And so there's a little bit of confusion. Maybe there's a lot of confusion about what's going to happen next year, because we have these new presidential caucuses that the Republican and Democratic Party are going to be doing next year, because the Idaho legislature seemingly unintentionally eliminated the presidential primary. And so in response to that, the Republican Party passed a rule over the summer where they tried to set December 31st, so coming up at the end of this calendar year, they tried to set December 31st as the deadline to be able to affiliate with the Republican Party in order to vote in the 2024 Republican primary election. But the Secretary of State is saying his job is to enforce the laws of Idaho and to make this change actually happened. The Republican Party would have needed to have a legislator introduce a bill and make this a law. And because that did not happen, the Secretary of State said they're not going to be enforcing that deadline. Essentially, that means they're not going to be cutting off party affiliation at the end of this year. And so folks actually have until March of 2024, if they would like to change their party affiliation to vote in the Republican primary election. That March deadline is actually the same deadline that candidates have in order to turn in their paperwork to file to run for office. And it gets a little bit confusing because what I talked about applied to the primary election. But if you want to vote in the Republican presidential caucus next year, which is going to be in March, then you do have to affiliate with the Republican Party by the end of the calendar year this year. But that only applies to the caucus, and the caucus only has to do with picking the Republican nominee for president. Right now, there's four candidates running, led by former President Donald Trump, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, and Nikki Haley. And so if you do want to vote in the Republican presidential caucus, if you have not already affiliated with the Republican Party, you need to do that by the end of this calendar year. But if you're already affiliated, or if you're only worried about the primary election, which is when our legislative seats will be up next year, then you don't have to worry about it. That's the deadline that the Secretary of State won't be enforcing. So there's a little bit of confusion, because rather than having a primary election, we're going to have a primary and a caucus. And so it's a little bit confusing. But the only thing folks need to keep in mind in terms of a deadline is if they want to vote in the Republican presidential caucus and they have not already affiliated with the Republican Party, they have till the end of this month. Otherwise, they don't need to worry about any of the other rules and any of the other confusion, because it is going to be different this year. It's going to be different than Idahoans are used to. And so I know we'll be doing more articles as relevant deadlines come up and reminding people about when the caucus is, versus when the primary election is. And I'd be happy to come back on the reporter roundup and share some of those details as some of those dates get closer, because we know 2024 is going to be a big election year across the country and in the state of Idaho as well. And we want to help people make their plans to participate and go out to the polls and share their voice and share their vote.
100%. And Clark, this originally, this confusion, but this idea of when you could change your party deadline, party affiliation, this was borne out by the GOP's belief of Democrats basically jumping in and out to vote in Republican primaries, correct?
Yeah, that's one of the main talking points. Is they say they want to shut it down and they want to have the Republican primary election and protect it for Republican voters. There was actually a different deadline depending on if you had switched from a different political party to affiliate with the Republican Party. There was going to be this additional 1 year waiting period. The Secretary of State says he can't enforce that when it comes to the primary election, again, because it was a party rule we're talking about, not the full force of law. But yeah, that's the idea, is the Republican Party is saying they want to protect their election and have it just be for Republican voters. And so that's the idea with the party affiliation. And the way the law is written in Idaho is the sort of de facto position is that the primary elections are closed for all political parties, and the Idaho Democratic Party is the only party that has opened its primary elections up and has signaled it will continue to do so when it comes to the primary. But all the other ones, so we're talking Republican Party, Constitution Party, Libertarian Party, those have all been closed primary elections. So a little bit confusing, but we're here to talk about the deadlines as they come up and let folks have the latest, most accurate information about how they can participate and how they can make their vote count this next year.
And with all the confusion, do you expect the Idaho Republican Party to do something about this? Maybe a bill in the next legislative session?
Yeah, they could bring a bill in the next legislative session. Absolutely. I think in a way that could have an effect potentially of adding to the confusion, because a lot of the deadlines for 2024 have already passed. So they could bring a bill, but it likely would not take effect until the next go around of primary elections, which would be 2026 and then 2028. So it could add to the confusion, because it's too late to make changes for 2024, because there's already deadlines that are getting us moving towards getting our ballots printed, getting the dates locked in, knowing which candidates are in the field. So it's too late to change that for 2024. But I do expect, especially if voters perceive, if they're confused by it, if they perceive that it limits participation and access, I think there will be pressure to bring a bill. I'm not sure when the bill could come forward, though, like I said, because of those timing elements.
Gotcha. All right. Sydney, tell us about this pair of developments off I-84 and Meridian Road. Very big projects, if I read the article correctly, in Boise Dev.
Yes. So the week of Thanksgiving at the Meridian City Council meeting, there was a joint public hearing held for a subdivision and a like kind of a retail center that's supposed to go in, or was proposed to go in, off of the northwest corner of Meridian Road and I-84. So a pretty busy corridor. And people came out to this public hearing. They, people in the area wanted to be heard on the matter. But basically what these developments are is the subdivision is designed to have 83 single family homes, 45 townhomes, and 280 apartments. And that will be built out in phases. And then the retail portion would have sort of two big box stores and then several different pads and shops sprinkled kind of throughout the development. And the reason why they came together to do this joint proposal is because it had been requested that the project for this area, the two projects for this area, kind of be work in tandem with each other and kind of work in harmony. So these properties are joined by a pedestrian bike path. And the developers said that they decided to do this instead of a road so that it would encourage more people to walk from the subdivision to the retail center and hopefully cut down on some of that traffic generation. But traffic generation was a big topic in this public hearing because with 280 apartments and a two big box stores, people are going to have more cars coming in and out of this area that's already pretty congested. So the public hearing and the subsequent deliberations for this lasted for over 4 hours. It was a very long meeting.
Wow.
for these two developments. And it ended in a split vote that Mayor Simison from Meridian had to weigh in and cast the tie-breaking vote. So it passed, both of them passed 3-2. And for the subdivision, that means that the preliminary plat has been approved and they can start moving toward the next steps and in getting the subdivision put out. The retail, though, that development that was proposed by Hawkins Companies, I should mention, it was just requesting annexation into the city and a rezone so that they can, you know what's approved to be built on that property and then later come forward with a little bit more of a specific plan for the city. And I failed to mention earlier, the subdivision that was proposed is being designed and put out by Engineering Solutions.
All right. Scott, you wrote an update to your story about charging for prison phone calls. You did this story a while back, and it was very poignant, and you have some more information. What's the latest on this one?
Well, right. After I wrote a series of articles about the opioid settlement funds, I wrote a follow-up story about the cost and difficulty of making phone calls and video calls from prisons and jails. I had spoken with a couple of women. One was in the Valley County Jail and one was in the Canyon County Jail. And the cost to call them was really kind of shocking. It was 21 cents a minute to make a phone call. And it was 25 cents a minute to make video calls. And it was very inconvenient and it was very expensive just to make a 30-minute interview was very expensive. And the costs are being borne by their families. You know, the people in jail and prison don't make any money, if much at all. And the families often have to bear these costs. And so after I wrote that story, I got an email from Ben Porter, who is the head of engineering for a company called Emilio. And Emilio is a nonprofit company that started in during the pandemic, and it got seed funding from folks like Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, and LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman. And it's a nonprofit company that provides technology for making phone and video calls from jails and prisons. And they're really trying to compete with these for-profit companies. And they're trying to make inroads. Now they're working with states that don't have a kickback system. So the big problem here is that counties and the state get kickbacks from these private companies to provide this service. So, for example, the Idaho Department of Correction received $1.5 million from its provider IC Solutions. Ada County received $540,000 last year from Telmate, and Canyon County received $130,000 last year from its contract with Telmate. And so you can see that these county officials and state officials, they have an incentive to keep these for-profit operations going because they get kickbacks for it. And that's on top of the profits that these for-profit companies make. And all of this money comes out of the pockets of the families of people who are incarcerated. And so, like I said, Emilio is working in states that don't have these kickback systems, Illinois, Iowa, and Maine. And they're making inroads in these states, competing for these contracts to provide these services in those jails and prisons. Ben Porter, who is the head of engineering for Emilio, he's based in Idaho Falls. The company itself is based in Connecticut, but he's based in Idaho Falls, and he's hoping to make some inroads in with Idaho. But, you know, it would require that this state legislature and the county commissioners would agree to not only give up those revenues that they get, but they would also have to pay a fee to Emilio, a smaller fee. It's a much smaller fee because they're not incentivized by the profit, that it's much cheaper to provide these phone call services. We'll see what happens. They're trying to make inroads in Idaho and reaching out to officials. I'm hoping that some state legislature or county commissioner reads my story and says, you know, this is really immoral what we're doing by making money off of the backs of the people who often can least afford it and really have no power and have no voice in our system. And somebody should do something about it to get rid of this really corrupt and immoral system.
Well, and you also pointed out in your story that even though they might lose some money in the short term, they might save money in the long term, because you say that prisoners who keep in contact with family members through things like phone calls tend to do better when they get out. There's less recidivism.
Right, right. And there's tons of studies out there that are showing that. Emilio is actually commissioning their own study on their own systems to see what those recidivism rates are. But they are much lower for people who maintain contact with friends and family. And you think about it, now they have a support system. They keep in touch with their family. They have somebody to go pick them up. They have somebody to put them up and have somewhere to stay. Maybe they can make contact with somebody to get a job, to line up a job once they get out. And then that reduces the number of folks who are coming back into the system for violating the parole or probation in Idaho. As it is, we are one of the highest, if not the highest, recidivism rate, or folks, the rate of people who are back in prison on parole or probation violations. So just violating a rule of probation or violation, 62% of our prison system is taken up by folks who have a violation of parole or probation. And so if you can increase and incentivize folks to maintain contact with friends and family, then maybe they won't get back into the prison as readily and will save costs in the long run.
Fascinating. It's a great story. Check it out in The Statesman. Clark, you took a look at a new map that shows that of the people who register to vote, far more Republicans from California than liberals are moving to Idaho. Tell us about this map.
Yeah, the map is wild. It's all red in 48 of the 49 states. But this data comes from voter registration files, and it's something that the Idaho Secretary of State's office released on Wednesday this week at a big Associated Taxpayer of Idaho conference. It's kind of like the kickoff to the legislative session. But a data visualization specialist at the Idaho Secretary of State's office named Gabe Osterhout worked on this report. And what he did was he entered voter registration data for 118,000 Idaho voters who moved here from another state. And then he mapped all of that information, and it's totally interactive. It's available at the bottom of my article at the Idaho Capital Sun. It's also available at the Idaho Secretary of State's office website on their dashboard section of their website. But it's really cool. You can click on a state and find out where people are moving from and then where they're moving to in Idaho based on the county. But what Gabe and the officials at the Secretary of State's office found is that no matter what state people are moving to Idaho from, no matter how progressive or liberal that state is, the majority of people here moving here are conservatives. And California is leading the charge. There are almost 40,000 Californians who moved to Idaho and registered to vote, and almost 30,000 of those people are Republicans. And so the data is interesting because in my mind, it kind of confirmed one myth and busted another. It confirmed that by far and away, in terms of adults, in terms of registered voters, California is fueling that growth, and there really isn't much competition. Like I said, 40,000 voters moving from California to Idaho and registering to vote here. So it confirms that California is leading that charge, but it also kind of busts this myth that I had been hearing a lot around the state Capitol building, that maybe with all this growth, Idaho would be turning purple or it would be turning blue. When in fact, the numbers are showing it the opposite thing. The percentage of voters moving here who register as Republicans is higher than the share of people who are already here and registered as Republicans. And so what it's showing is that people are moving from more progressive states, and the conservatives are coming here, and it's actually making Idaho's electorate even more conservative than before. There's a ton of information. You can break it down by age. You can break it down by what state that they came from. But when I talked to Idaho Secretary of State Phil McGrane and asked him, what does this data tell you? What does it mean? He said that in his mind, it really underscores the importance of voting in elections, particularly the primary elections, because Republicans have such huge majorities, and because for decades now, all of the statewide elected officials have been Republicans who have come out of the Republican primary elections. So if you're interested in data, if you're interested in party affiliation, if you're interested in the growth that we've been experiencing in Idaho, we all know that Idaho was one of the fastest growing states in the country over the last 10 years. We know that Meridian and Ada County were among the fastest growing places in the country. This data is useful because it gives us that much more information about where's the growth coming from and what's the party affiliation of the people who are moving here. I think that this growth is something that we're going to be taking stock of for a long time, and the way that it affects and changes Idaho. And so this just gives us more information, but it's a huge sample size. Like I said, almost 120,000 voters. It's actual data taken from voter registration cards in Idaho. So it's not an estimate. It's not a projection. It's a huge sample size. And it's, I enjoy the element of being able to go through the map and click on the different cities, find out where folks are coming from and moving to in Idaho. And again, you can find that at the Secretary of State's website, under the dashboards tab, or you can find it. We wrote a big article at the Idaho Capital Sun, and you'll know you see it because the map of the U.S. Is just red. It's like a Republican fever dream, but it's illustrating that from 48 of the 49 other states, the majority of folks who are coming here are Republicans. They are affiliating with the Republican Party. So it was kind of cool to have this new information that hadn't been available before. And the Secretary of State's office has a number of data visualization projects on their website where you can get into party makeup of Idaho voters. You can look at absentee ballot requests. You can look at maps and ages. And so it's a lot more information and kind of interactive tools that we're seeing Secretary McGrane and his staff releasing just this year. And so I thought it was kind of cool. And I know that everybody talks about this growth that we're seeing, and there's a lot of rumors out there about where people may be coming from and what their political views may be. And so I thought this was cool to actually look at some data and get a little bit closer to understanding this rapid growth that Idaho is experiencing. So I thought it was a cool thing to highlight. And I know Gabe had been working on it since August. And so a ton of effort went into this, and I thought it was cool to highlight.
Awesome. We'll check out the map. Go to the Idaho Capital Sun and you'll see it. Thanks, Clark. Rachel, you've got about 2 minutes to tell us about the Sawtooth Valley Trail. There was an update, a Ninth Circuit Court ruling. What's the latest?
Yeah, the latest is that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, it ruled in favor of the Forest Service again with regards to whether this trail is legal. The lawsuit was filed in 2019, and the trail only opened this summer to the public. And there had been contention about it for the past 4 years, but the Ninth Circuit again ruled basically in favor of the Forest Service, saying that, yep, the trail is valid and potentially more appeals to come, but it's unclear right now.
All right. And people can use the trail right now. It is open.
It is open. The winter situation, I think snowmobiling has historically been allowed in that area. So I think it's still open even with snow.
Gotcha. And Sydney, is it true, and I hate to date myself, the village in Meridian is really 10 years old?
I know, it's a lot to process. I was in high school when the village opened, and I remember everybody being so excited. But yes, it's been open for 10 years now, as of October 18th. And it's going, things are going well at the village. They have one vacancy, a restaurant vacancy that was left when Texas de Brazil left. But other than that, everybody's full. People are excited about a certain burger joint that should be opening soon. And Hugh Crawford says that sales are up this year by about 8% at the village, that they had a really strong turnout to the holiday season. And they're looking to the future. They said they're not resting on their laurels, that they are excited about the expansion that they have filed for with the city of Meridian called the Bridge, which will bring some housing to the village as well as more retail and restaurant spaces.
And a lot of apartment housing, is that right?
Yes, lots of apartment housing. It's going to have a pair of 6-story apartment buildings that are connected by a sky bridge.
Wow. Okay. That's impressive. Okay. Thanks for dating us all. and I guess happy birthday to the village. We want to thank everybody who came on the show today. The panel, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Sydney Kidd with BoiseDev.com, and Rachel Cohen, South Central Idaho reporter for Boise State Public Radio News. And I want to thank everybody who was on, especially Rachel and Sydney. Thanks for sticking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you know you are physically adapting to all your swiping, scrolling, and tapping?
We're changing our bodies and what they're able to do through our habits.
NPR's Body Electric, a special interactive series investigating how to fix the relationship between our tech and our health. Listen in the TED Radio Hour feed wherever you get your podcasts.